Hello again, listeners. Back again here with Living Indigenous Media. Hope you're having a wonderful day. Today's episode is focused on film, and our guest is a man that I consider a mentor of mine, a really, in my opinion, prominent scholar. I think his work is really important. He's focused a lot on history and the Native American aspect of it, and that's Dr. Eric Anderson here from Haskell Indian Nations University, a prominent figure in my journey. I will say that his classes helped shape a lot of my understanding of the social standing of Native Americans and the historical standing as well. His class, American Indian Film, I took when I was probably a sophomore at Haskell, and it's still influencing me today. It kind of sparked my media studies journey. Whatever realms of media I'm exploring has a tinge of that. And it's still being taught today, so something has to be going right. This was a really fun interview for me. I don't get enough time to sit down and talk with him like I would. He's a very busy guy, and I really appreciate you listening. I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. If at any point you want to send a message to me, hit me at my email at raincharger@ku.edu. Send me a conversation. Did you like the podcast episode? Did you not? Is there a guest you want me to feature? Do you have ideas? I'm pretty open, and I'd love to start a friendly conversation. So without much further ado, this is our interview with Dr. Eric Anderson.
I'm here with Dr. Eric Anderson. He's a professor at Haskell Indian Nations University from, I believe, the Citizen Band Potawatomi, right?
That's correct.
Awesome. Well, we're going to have a little discussion today about Native American film, Native Americans' role in film, their appearance in film, and just kind of along those rails. I guess my rationale for this discussion is, we've had class together. I've been one of your students mm-hmm. in a past life. And honestly, my whole media journey right now has been kind of inspired by your one class, American Indian Film, which I took, I think, when I was a sophomore or second semester freshman or something.
I remember.
It was
so nice to hear that.
It's really been, when I got to Haskell, I knew that I could mixed music and Indigenous studies knowledge, but I had never really gone to that further intersection of just media as a whole, and I really kind of blossomed my I started working with the film club more here right. on campus, and we started shooting sketches and stuff. One thing we learned in there is that Natives have always been a part of the film industry or a part of the film sure. dialogue. Do you want to kind of expound on that and kind of our the Native country's role in film at the very beginning?
Well, I guess, being trained as an historian, I always am obligated, I suppose, to contextualize things within time. So it's really even before film.
Right.
The images of Native people, Native American people, American Indians and Alaska Natives, have been recurrent from the very beginning of the encounters with outsiders who arrived here, who invaded, and their fascination with those Native peoples. And I'm less inclined to say fascination with their cultures, because right. I think there was much less of an understanding, or in many cases even a desire to understand that, but that they were fascinated, these outside peoples, with ideas about primitivism, as we would call it academically, in comparing their own societies to those of Native people, and this illusion that Native people were somehow simple, and not complex, and that there was something more graceful, more honorable, to exalt those modes of living that they viewed as less complex than their own, and by extension to say that they were devoid of the trappings of civilization, and that that was admirable in some way. So those images, those thoughts that, of course, are coming through the lens of outsiders, not truly understanding either the complexity of Native peoples or the cultures, the diverse and divergent range of cultures that they represented, you know, that was an ethnocentric expression that came through writings, that came through ethnography, that came through a whole host of Wild West shows, you know, before we ever got to film. But more directly to your question, when we arrive at the point where the technology of film emerges in the late 19th century, among the very first images are Native people, Zuni dancers, the dime novels and the Fenimore Cooper books of the earlier part of the 19th century had also, of course, promulgated that fascination with Indians. And so when film emerged, it just got translated to that. And right. So many of the misrepresentations and culturally blinded, ethnocentric points of view emerged in film. Interesting, though, too, there were a lot of Native people involved in film at the beginning or near the beginning, and then that kind of went away for a good part of the 20th century.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So along with that, you know, one of the discussions we've had a lot in this podcast has kind of been academic gatekeeping. You know, mm-hmm. I think that you see that a lot, maybe not just academic gatekeeping, but cultural gatekeeping for any of these kind of movements in media. Do you want to expound on that a little bit more, I guess, with some of those earlier filmmakers or those earlier people who were involved?
Well, I think there was a freedom in the early kind of first golden age of Hollywood filmmaking. It was an exciting time. It was an exciting medium. And I don't know exactly how to pinpoint it, but I think several different forces kind of converged to allow Native people to be part of that freeing and exciting environment. The creativity itself, I think, lends itself to, you know, a whole range of different people. Hollywood, I think, touts itself, at least in more recent times, as being, you know, liberal to a fault.
Right.
I don't know that that's exactly true. You know, and in its earlier days, while there were a lot of creative people who were, given to broad appetites, there's also a lot of control, you know, by the studios. And I think that increased with time, and that began to shut out some of those more diverse voices. But I think the ability to create was one aspect of it. I also think there was some carryover from things like Wild West shows. Of course, a lot of Native people were actually featured in films mostly as extras.
Right.
You know, very few were the center stage. But, you know, there were some who were involved in directing. A lot of information has come out in the last few years about, now I'm not going to be able to think of his name, but the director who was at least acknowledged as being part African American, and now it looks like perhaps he was not Native at all, but had claimed Native heritage. So in a little, maybe a little cultural appropriation there. Perhaps his name will come back to me. Some of your listeners will know who I'm right. talking about.
Yeah.
It just escapes me at the moment. But
at this point, make sure to comment, listeners.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, I think this is, you know, pre-Hays Code and stuff that I'm thinking of, too. So there was an ability to engage with, you know, certain themes that might not have been discussed had there been earlier forms of censorship. So I'm thinking of, you might remember watching that very short film, White Fawn's Devotion,
right?
You know, which is laden with stereotypes, but at the same time, it's confronting some things that are pretty risque for, you know, the 1910s, intermarriage, for instance. Right. You know, and we still had laws on the books in many states about, you know, race mixing, miscegenation, right? So I think that that's that gate, as you say, was a little more open. Now, at the same time, there was an enormous amount of stereotyping taking place, even, I think, to some extent, by natives themselves, less as an expression of self-colonization, perhaps, than as one of, you know, go along to get along. You know, the same kind of rationale that might have led a Sitting Bull or others to participate in Wild West shows, because, you know, the opportunities were very few.
Very much so. I guess let's go ahead and jump ahead a few years. One of the connections I always have kind of wanted to make or to highlight, and we talked about it a good amount in the class, was the films of John Ford. Mm-hmm. You know, very much a Western, pretty much all of his movies were Westerns. Featured some form of natives, generally in the capacity of an enemy, mm-hmm. a hated enemy, especially in some of the later John Wayne films. And they're just kind of a mess from a native standpoint. You know, it's a lot of Monument Valley shots, sure. with a lot of Plains headwear.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I know we talked about this a little bit with the dime store novels, but is that just a continuation of like this pop culture fascination with Indians at the time? Or do you think John Ford had a little bit more malicious intent?
Well, John Ford's a pretty nuanced character, I think, in some ways. Well, people might disagree with me, but, and I'm basing this upon the readings of his films rather than maybe any commentary he might have made, or maybe even the commentary of others. But, you know, he was around in those early days of filmmaking. I do think the fascination with Indians, you know, was there right from the beginning. It had been, you know, transmogrified from the other forms of media, print media, and, you know, the carnivals of the Wild West shows. So it was a, you know, it was a top seller. It was always going to be a money-making proposition. And, of course, the justification of colonization that has been a part and parcel of film, whether consciously or not, to represent, for instance, you know, Ford had dealt with Indians back in the silent days, as had others, you know, the battle of Elderberry Gulch or something like that is a very early one. Indians are portrayed very negatively in much the same way as other films of the time, like Birth of a Nation, were representing, you know, African Americans in a very unflattering light, to say the least, and exalting the Klan and things like that. So, you know, it's a very racially charged and divided society. Ford's intent is a little harder to get a hold of, because with Stagecoach in 1939, you have, to some extent, really the granddaddy of the Western genre, in the form of a talkie. I mean, it's right. The earlier films that were silent, but the Indians, you know, from the beginning, are to be despised, to be feared, to be overcome, to be defeated. So there's a part of that mythic narrative of the West. Indians are obstacles. Indians are on a rampage for no apparent reason. You have a maybe slightly more sympathetic portrayal of the Cheyenne messenger at the beginning of the film, but certainly the Apaches, who are the main Indian representation, although you very rarely see them, they are the enemy. They are the other, and you know by the music, you know, that it gets your blood pumping. You know who you're supposed to sympathize with. The white resettlers in this metaphoric stagecoach, this vessel of civilization, supposed civilization, that, you know, is reaching out to spread the gospel of capitalism, of democracy, of redevelopment, of redefinition of the West. We don't get the side of the story about why the Apaches are so damn angry that, you know, this is an invasion. So it does typify the mythos and justification. Now, we could move then to, the one that you were thinking of with John Wayne as Ethan Edwards, right? We could talk about his baldly racist language and behavior, in this film from 15 or so years later, right? I think it's 1953, 54, and yes. We're thinking of, shooting an already dead Indian in the face, and this notion in The Searchers of Indians are so dreadful, so horrible, so absent of any kind of humanity, that the very idea of the girl they're searching for, Debbie, being tainted by them makes John Wayne's character's blood not only boil, but he says he's going to shoot her. He's going to kill her, you know? She can't be redeemed. Now, all that being said, I also like to show something from John Ford, rather's last Western, mm-hmm. Cheyenne Autumn, adapted from the book by Mari Sandoz, which is a very sympathetic portrayal of the flight of the Cheyennes, Dull Knife and Little Wolf, from essentially imprisonment in Oklahoma back to their homelands. And the movie is in many ways much more epic than the previous two, arguably. What's interesting is that the savagery in that film is not emanating from the Indian characters. Right. It's emanating from the white characters, who are the cowboys, who are set on pursuing, destroying them, the thrill of, I'm going to kill me an Indian. So we have a very different kind of representation from John Ford in that film. Now, whether that is a change of heart over time, whether he was trying to send a very nuanced message in the earlier films of pointing out the abject racism.
Right.
You know, we don't know exactly, but it's interesting to consider, because we do have some very different things that change over time, you know, because Cheyenne Autumn's 10 years after, after Stagecoach, and it makes for quite interesting fodder, right?
Right, it totally does. I don't think you get away from that that discussion of kind of representation and this, like, we're talking the pop culture fascination. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can separate those from any discussion about Native film. I guess another thing I want to do is I haven't meant to be chronological, but I know you're a historian. let's go a little farther with that. And I guess you kind of get into discussions of, like, the mystic savage, mm-hmm. or I'm thinking of Billy Jack,
right?
You know, and movies like this of the kind of flower power hippie era,
right?
Where do you think they kind of fit in with this whole conversation?
So, yeah, Indians remain popular, and popular in different periods for different reasons, whether it's the noble savage in one place, whether it's the despised savage, the violent, rampaging, senseless savage in another era. Of course, they're constant themes. You know, they still run through film and other forms of media. to what the filmmaker, documentary filmmaker Neil Diamond, the Cree director of that fabulous documentary, The Real Engine,
right,
calls the groovy Indian. You know,
right,
in a period where the young people of the dominant society are doing something that is, on the one hand, admirable. They're displaying a reverence for native people, and they're trying to act in a sympathetic way to, you know, say, hey, we know what our ancestors did was wrong. We have a lot to learn from you. But, of course, at the same time, there's a lot of cultural appropriation by that very same group. There's a lot of, you know, be the Indian that I want you to be, that as I understand it.
Right.
And that's not that different from the primitivist French writers of the 17th or 18th centuries, right?
No.
So that strain runs through there. You know, and for instance, the, you know, Billy Jack you mentioned, you know, in my class, although it clearly is a timepiece and reflects, you know, very much the ethos and the dress and the language of the street theater and so forth of the 60s and 70s, you know, I sort of put that one in the category of the white Indian, with quotation marks around the word Indian, because in that film, in certainly Dances with Wolves, The Little Big Man, which is closer in time to Billy Jack, and to a certain extent, even The Revenant, we have, you know, it's the white person, male figure, who is the savior, is the better Indian than the Indians themselves. You know, I'm thinking back again to Hawkeye in Last of the Mohicans,
right,
you know, a film version of which was made three times in the 20th century, by the way. You know, I even think of Wind River a little bit, you know, because it's a movie that's ostensibly about Indians, but it's really about two white saviors who come in and are gonna, you know, carry the day. So I see the Billy Jack fitting in that way. Well, I think it's admirable, you know, what the filmmakers tried to do. But it's a little stale by now, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't just mean because it's kind of stuck in the 70s. I mean, it's really not that different in some ways than what had come even centuries before. There was film. But the clothes and the language are different. You know?
Right. I guess you kind of hit it on the head where I was wanting to go with that. You know, you get into areas like Dances with Wolves, mm-hmm, and you see the same narrative kind of like rearing its ugly head again.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for me, the next question becomes, okay, so do we get Native actors into these spaces without them being tokenized?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you still see, you think of like the kind of transition period from the 90s to the 2000s, yeah. Adam Beach, he's a great actor,
yeah,
but it always kind of has I know for me, it always felt a little bit like he was the tokenized. And you can get into the discussion of, yes, positive representation is happening, mm-hmm, or some representation,
mm-hmm,
but do we still need to be having that discussion of, is some representation better than no representation?
Right. You know, I think that's a great question, especially in the shadow of the Black Panther movie, because, you know, I had a discussion with one of the people I saw it with, and, you know, he's like, why are all of these African-American people, or even other minority people, because it's a very popular movie with the students here at Haskell, too,
right,
why are they, you know, holding this up as a great paragon of, you know, empowerment or equality or something like that. And I, you know, because there, pardon me, there are, you know, images that in some ways stereotypify those that colonizers have delivered to us of Africans, you know, and African Americans as well. But my response was, well, you know, when I think about natives in film and, you know, for instance, when Dances with Wolves came out and people were just gaga because a little bit of change goes very long ways,
right.
You know, to see any kind of more accurate representation, you know, beyond the dreck of, you know, what had been the standard for so many decades, I think has an appeal. It's almost a gut reaction that I think sometimes we have to sit with for a while before we can analyze it. Okay, well, that was great. We had native actors in, you know, in top roles. Graham Greene, you know, and Gary Farmer. We think about, you know, Smoke Signals or others, but in some ways, they're still in a subordinate role or occupying places that have the ability to embody stereotypes. And I think of, you know, in Dances with Wolves, for instance, here we got, you know, people speaking Lakota, perhaps not the right version of it. You know, I'm not a native speaker myself, so I can't say, but I have heard that perhaps that they're not speaking quite the right version, and maybe using the feminine instead of...
If I could interject, my dad had a story about this because it was filmed very near where we lived. The language, one of the language directors or the language consultants was a relative of my dad's. And he would get on her because apparently she taught Kevin Costner the feminine endings for Lakota, which, you know, is just kind of a teasing thing. But we've run into that. Okay, so, you know, we're talking of, like, any representation is a little progressive. I have heard a lot of discussion about Black Panther that's not completely unproblematic. Some people are kind of mad that the dialects used for Wakandans aren't actually accurate for that area of Africa it's supposed to be in. So I've heard these different things, but I think most modern African-American people will say that it's a pretty solid representation of Africa, and I've heard that coming out of Africa.
It's an improvement, you know, in many ways, and that's the same. That's what I was driving at. You know, with Dances with Wolves, you know, we have a great improvement there. Even going back to Little Big Man, you know, that's sort of the one that broke a lot of ground in humanizing Native peoples, and there have been a number of those in intervening years, even going up to the time of Dances with Wolves, which is now, what, you know, 26 years ago.
Right.
But in a film like Dances with Wolves, you have these Lakota actors. You have actual Indians who have, you know, major roles. The language is being spoken. But you have that same old dichotomy. You still have the bad Indians in the form of the Pawnees because they happen to be the enemy of the Lakotas, and because, you know, they made a choice as to, for their own survival, to ally themselves with the United States government, you know? So the script was flipped, and I don't think any filmmaker, any person, you know, is that black and white, that Manichaean, you know, it's a matter of nuance. So although I don't normally go to movies with the expectation of it being, you know, the place I'm going to get or recommend people to get their history, because it does paint with broad brushstrokes, you know, I think it's fascinating to see when film takes on some of those deeper questions of whether it be encounters, whether it be, you know, before colonization began, before outsiders arrived. You know, I love the film Black Rope. I know a lot of Native people who have many criticisms of it, but I think it displays something that very few films do, and that is the nuances of those meeting grounds, the intentions on two different levels, the exceptionalities of the two, at least two, worldviews being expressed, and putting that firmly within the context of, you know, what makes people tick, what are their cultural priorities, what's right. important to them, and how that can lead to so easily to misunderstanding, which then develops into conflict and very often violence.
Right. More and more, I think we're going to start seeing Native filmmakers taking a helm. I know recently, again, back to Marvel, but Taika Waititi doing Thor Ragnarok and also doing tons of other pretty successful films. We're seeing, you know, not just peoples of the North American natives, but also kind of like indigenous peoples around the world starting to step into these realms. I guess kind of one thing I've wanted to ask you is where do you see that going? Do you see people talking about their own stories and tellings? Do you see people creating narrative fiction in their own kind of cultural context? Where do you kind of see Native film going as a direction?
Yeah, so I mean, with independent film, it's given us so much on so many levels. And you know, Hollywood cannot ignore it. We have films regularly now that are up for Academy Awards that come out of, you know, small kind of art house outfits, or at least ones that began that way before they are gobbled up by the big studios. And that's kind of like smoke signals. That's kind of like, what's Chris Ayer's other film? That's got Graham Greene and Gary Farmer as the brothers. It's another independent type of film that I think confronts stereotypes, sometimes flirts with them a little bit, but as a means, as a vehicle for understanding.
Skins,
yes of course.
That's the other big one.
Right. So I think that was that's a great and promising start. We have seen the Whale Rider, you know, it's set in a different, you know, indigenous population. We are starting to see some of those stories, even some harking to the tribal roots of Western peoples, you know, as you mentioned, like with Thor and that, you know, that constellation of beliefs in those gods that are very flawed gods, you know, very human in that way. I'm thinking also of, I don't think you have to be a critic of all things. And I should say this because I probably come across as critical about certain things. I don't think you have to be a critic of all things to critique, to understand. You know, so for whatever faults a Black Panther or a Revenant or Dances with Wolves or those things may have, or even those independent films, there is some genuine good and progress. And progress is, you know, a work in progress, right? So there was another film I was thinking of, and it just flew away from my head. It's the end of an incredibly long day. And my brain is glop, it seems like. But, you know, I think Fast Runner.
Right.
I was thinking of. You know, a film like that is, you know, as Chris Ayer himself said, you know, so indigenous, it's like, you know, nothing we had ever really seen on the screen before. You know, of course, we could hark back to Nanak of the North, you know, almost 100 years before, but that's another story. Because that's not totally indigenous, even though it is kind of the first documentary, and it deals with Native people. But Fast Runner, you know, being told in its own language, you're just dropped right into the belief system of the people that are featured in the film. And that is such a powerful and empowering approach to film for anyone who's concerned about indigenous filmmaking. You don't have to be from that culture to see the power in that.
Right. And, you know, I think for me, where I can see Native film going, outside of just kind of, you know, your narrative fictions and your kind of, I don't want to say your standard films, but I can start to see more experimental kind of ideas coming out. And I know we're kind of cutting down. One people that you may not consider filmmakers, but I think that they're using video kind of as a really solid medium is like this, the comedy group, the 1491s.
Yes.
They did Willie Jack.
Right.
The son of Billy Jack.
Yes.
As a kind of parody. Uh-huh. I remember there's a video of Redcorn.
Yeah.
He's dancing to a discoed version of I'm an Indian Too from Annie Get Your Gun.
Uh-huh,
and so you see these kind of subversive forms coming out. Do you kind of see like these experimental or kind of not your normal factors being like the kind of the movement that's happening?
Yeah, I think it's been happening for a while. That's a great example. But you know, there are students on this campus who are making little short films, who are playing, you know, with some of the ideas, you know, with the indigenous zombies and things like that, right? And, you know, I think of what Francis Ford Coppola said many years ago, and it is something I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, we think of, you know, these giant names in film that we all look up to, you know, a Citizen Kane or something like that. But the next great iconic film like that in 20 or 30 years, he's saying, it's going to be made from some, you know, awkward little teenage girl in Minneapolis, right? Because with the availability, the access to both financially and just due to the fact that we live in a very consumer society, the access to the technology to make film has been ripped away from the powers that be.
Right.
And so you are empowered to make your own reality and one that reflects more accurately, you know, who we are.
Right.
And that, I think, is, you know, where I would leave it and encourage people to do that very thing. You know, tell your stories, and they will be the counter narrative to what has come before.
Awesome. Well, I think we can't really get much further than that today, Dr. Anderson. I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure.
Again, this is Living Indigenous Media, and thank you for being on.
Thank you, Rain.
Well, there it is. You know, it's always an interesting discussion. Anytime I have a chance to be able to sit down with Dr. Anderson, I don't think I've actually ever had a boring conversation with the guy. and any of my compatriots or anyone who's had any interaction with him, I think would kind of feel the same. You know, I'd love to unpack some more of our conversation. So maybe, you know, further on down the road, Dr. Anderson and I can have another sit down and maybe talk a little more about the historical aspect of indigenous life and in particular different forms of indigenous media. I know he's got a lot more to say. Maybe catch him on a day where he's not as tired. Kind of a hard prospect for any university teacher. I'm sure our academic audience can attest to that. Well, you know, I won't keep you very much longer. I appreciate your listening. I appreciate your listenership. If this is your first episode of Living Indigenous Media, I hope you stick with us. I hope you, you know, find something you like. I hope you find a conversation that you enjoy in these episodes here. And if there's an episode or a content creator, again, that you want me to maybe, you know, try to get an interview with, I'm open to that. Send me an email at raincharger@ku.edu and let's see what we can get going. If you are a content creator or a media person in general and feel like having a conversation about media, send me one of those. Send me one of those. I'm your host, Rain Charger, and this has been Living Indigenous Media. Wopula.